Summer's officially upon us. In Moscow, Idaho, we have to remind ourselves of this fact by noting the calendar rather than the weather. We've waited long for temperatures to hit the 70s, which they finally did, only to fall back to the chilly, rainy 60s. But we're optimistic, very optimistic. I pulled out my summer clothes, summer dresses, skirts and shorts, tank tops and swimsuits, sandals. I put them on each day. Then I put a sweater on over them and sometimes a rain jacket. Today is the day for shorts. It's a day for shorts to remind us that it's summer. If I translate this into a radio program, it becomes a collection of short pieces. So that's what I have for you today. Collection of short pieces from the past and one that's brand new. 16 installments, all less than a minute long. Not too long to tax the short attention span that we get as we're planning our summer outings and playing summer games and eating picnics and soaking in the joys of summer. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. Today's show is Summer Shorts. We've got some insights from nuns, advice from experts, poetry, stories, and more, including music from Daisy May. So let's start there. With a fun bluesy song from Daisy May. It's called Miss She Spins.
Shop till you drop, never look at the clock till your gold card has melted away. A new pair of shoes, it's a cure against the blues, but you have to do it every day. Some clothes you had to buy, some you don't even try. You met some old folks you bought yesterday. They call me Miss She Spends, the money's my husband's. Tell me please, doesn't matter. It's never three enough, it must be 2 days must. The next week does just
summer shorts. Short attention span, short pants, and short radio pieces. It's summer. And, like Miss Daisy, everyone sings. Back around the Christmas holidays, I ask people to sing their favorite holiday song. Here's one contribution.
My favorite holiday song is Walking Round in Women's Underwear.
Is that the only verse to it?
I can't remember the rest. Lacy things the wife is missing. Didn't ask for her permission. I'm wearing her clothes, her silk pantyhose. Walking around in women's underwear.
Now I've got something completely different. It's from the venerable Thubten Chodron, an American woman, a Buddhist nun. She also does prison work.
I also do prison work, which I found extremely valuable. I never had the intention to do that. It just kind of fell into my lap. But I really enjoy it and benefit from it so much. So I write to inmates, I go to prisons and speak to Buddhist groups or counsel inmates individually. We have a little newsletter that we send out to inmates. And I've been able to go to prisons here and in Mexico when I've gone there to teach, and also in Singapore when I've gone there to teach. So, and I just find it very beneficial working with people who are sincerely trying to change their minds. Like, you know, the inmates who come to Buddhism, they're quite sincere in trying to change.
Another nun is Sister Carol Ann Waspeth. She's a Benedictine monastic who works in social justice and forest management at St. Gertrude's Monastery in Cottonwood, Idaho. She's been a nun for more than 40 years. While most of us can see the allure of living outside of the regular world in a community of like-minded women, everyone's curious about one particular element of cloistered life: sex. How do you live without it?
I was in the community for almost 10 years before I could make any kind of final commitment, so I had plenty of time to think about it. I don't think at the beginning it was that much of a question for me. Just because I was so busy having fun teaching those kids and doing all that kind of stuff. There was a time in my life when, yes, I questioned the whole celibacy thing and really started getting in touch with my own sexuality. But I think we had some very healthy input on that. You know, it wasn't like denying your sexuality. It was like looking at it and saying, okay, how do I express my sexuality? And one of the things that I realized, especially once I started working in parishes, is that I am a very strong heterosexual. Because that's a whole gamut, you know, and you fall somewhere on this gamut. You know, some people are stronger than other, and I am a very strong heterosexual, which simply to me means I need, in order to be healthy, I need to have interaction with men. You know, and seeing in the parish, that was no problem. I worked side by side with a lot of men and interacted with them and taught them and, you know, was on committees with them and the whole thing and had good men friends there. And see, that's the thing I really start realizing, that if I was going to be healthy, I needed to develop healthy relationships with men as well as women. They don't need to be sexual, or, well, I guess, they're always, but they don't need to be genital. I mean, you know, they can be good, healthy relationships, and that's how I would remain healthy. And when I came back to the monastery, that was, oh dear, there aren't a lot of men running around here. But then I got involved in the forest management and work with a lot of men there, and we've just gotten to be good friends, and I keep up my relationship and friends with, my friendship with the men that I knew, as well as the women. I mean, I just have very good friends, both in community, but outside community as well. And so, it's kind of funny because, of, you know, 40 years ago, I'd have never believed I'd be doing this because life was very different at that time. But I have a good friend, a gentleman who used to live here at Winchester. We got to know each other when we worked together on human rights issues and worked together with the Nez Perce tribe. And he's since moved to Boise, and we stay in touch. And when I go to Boise for business or whatever, I always let him know I'm coming, and we figure out a night, and he comes, picks me up, and we go out and have a glass of wine and have dinner and have a marvelous conversation. And I mean, it's as close to a date as you can get. I mean, it is. It's a beautiful experience, you know, and it's a great time. I thoroughly enjoy it, and he brings me back and back to my friends or wherever I'm staying. And it's something I need. And I think he also, it's a good experience for him too. And the thing is, we both know, and my other man friends too, that it's never going to develop into anything else. It is just a simple friendship where we can share ideas and share, you know, fun together and just let it be at that. And so that's, I think a good part of this is, it kind of slips back to what I just said, a healthy recognition of who we are and our own sexuality. And yes, I can't deny that, and I can't suppress it, and I can't say that there's anything wrong with it. I simply need to find ways that are healthy, that fit into my lifestyle, where I can take care of that need for intimacy, for that kind of friendship.
From sexuality to creativity, this next collection of short pieces is from poets, performers, and authors. Elizabeth Bradfield grew up in Tacoma, Washington, lived many years in Alaska, and works as a web designer and naturalist in Cape Cod. She's the author of two books of collected poems. This poem is called Endurance.
And this poem is called Endurance, and it's inspired by the long-distance swimmer Lynn Cox, but it really has not that much to do with her. It's called Endurance. There's a woman now swimming the English Channel or the Bering Sea or across some other impossible water between unimportant shores, miles of it. She sips from cups extended over the waves on a pole. She cannot hear voices and measures time in breaths. I'd love to see her entering the water, capped and suited, greased for the psychological edge of speed and warmth, and to save her skin from the pickling brine. I'd love to see her stumbling out on the other shore, knees unused to weight, buckling. Of course, this is how I see love, something of endurance and unreasonable calm, harder to attempt once you've known the numbing tiredness, the unrelenting salt, the safe boat unable to gather you up if you want the miles to count for anything, and you wade in anyway.
Liz Bradfield shared her poems with Yin Radio and University of Idaho students while on fellowship from Stanford University. Creative nonfiction writer and teacher Joy Passanante laughs. This next installment, the fifth on today's collection of summer shorts, is from her short story, My Red Dress Voice.
My Red Dress Voice. I am a woman who laughs. I laugh often, often inappropriately. And I don't just laugh. I bend at the waist, wrap my arms around my middle, shake my shoulders as if I'm a lead singer in a rock band, hyped up on ego and drugs. And I roll under tables, slide from chairs. I make, well, noise. People are continually commenting on my laugh and the voice that produces it. Even people I've just met and whose names I haven't caught have informed me, with varying degrees of goodwill, that my laugh is contagious, infectious, and just plain loud. I can call my insurance agent, whom I don't speak with more than once a year, or the mother of a friend I haven't seen in decades, and they will say, "Hello, Joy," as soon as they hear me ask for whomever it is I want to speak with. The sounds I make are apparently familiar, distinct. And as I stride, still muscular short legs pumping, pewter hair flying around my neck, toward what statistics indicate will be my third and final trinity of decades, I have a ripple of a suspicion that my most significant, monumental, and perhaps important escapist pleasure is this laugh. No matter how stressed I am, no matter how many problems I have spent the day enumerating or feeling helpless against, when I laugh with all the stops pulled out, I feel released. I think of a volcano, a geyser, Sisyphus on a holiday. For those seconds, I am the freest woman I can imagine.
Now it's time for an actor. Actors create personalities and situations. Andriette Piron is an actor, and she works with other actors who pose as clients at the veterinary clinic at Washington State University. They throw their fictional personalities and scenarios at the vet students and see what happens. In installment number 6, Andriette talks with fellow actor Luis Guerrero about creating a character and a situation.
My role in this particular scene has been to be pissed off. And so that's pretty easy to do when you're 6'1 and you know, 250 pounds, and I have a voice, and I'm a man, and I can just have an attitude and just pretend to not care. I don't care about this person. I take up the whole space. My voice fills the whole room, and I'm unapologetic. And I'll just beam them into the wall if they don't do anything. You know, they're just confused, and I rattle them, and that, in terms of the character, gives me some degree of pleasure because I have power, and that power just goes right through them, and they have to deal with that. So that's one way, just using my size.
Right. Do they feel pretty scared, do you think?
Oh, it's been really surprising to see, you know, I mean, I know I'm playing a role, but in that moment, I'm actually getting upset. And I'm not pretending anymore. I actually go home upset, and I have to talk to my partner to calm down because I'm mad.
Right.
And I'm mad that I'm here. I'm mad that they made me wait 30 minutes. I mean, this is all the scenario that they've given me. I've been sitting there for 30 minutes, and they come in, and then they apologize. And I tell them, what good is your apology? You know, apology doesn't solve anything. I said, I would say, be more understanding. I said, I understand that you're upset. Let's sit down and get this taken care of so we can get you out of here. But instead, they say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. And they're just constantly apologizing. I feel like, you know,
makes you even madder.
Makes me even madder. That doesn't help me at all.
Right.
That's not being understanding at all. And so I get to play the heavy guy and with a big voice and just say, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with this operation? You know, what kind of business do you run here?
Right.
And so there's a lot of fun to that. But the side effect, though, is that as an actor, I go away from this session and I have to, takes me about half an hour to calm down because
right.
I'm actually a pretty mellow guy.
Have you ever had a situation where somebody was able to calm you down and sort of disarm you and understand?
The best one today was when they said, Mr. Dunlop, and by the way, that's not my name,
yeah.
Mr. Dunlop, would you like a glass of chocolate?
A glass of chocolate.
A glass of chocolate. And I just totally just broke and started smiling. I mean, that was the most effective way to just make me just, you know, be mellow. And I said, sure, of course I'd like a glass of chocolate.
Great. So using food or drink is a good way.
Food or drink is always a good way to...
If you have an angry person in front of you.
How about a little glass of chocolate for you?
Yeah
sure. So that was good.
Cool.
Yeah, and there was one other girl that, I shouldn't say girl, young woman who... there was another young woman who just immediately cued into the fact that here's this guy who's pissed off and said, I understand, Mr. Dunlop. We're going to just do these three things and get you out of here. And I said, great, that's all I want.
Good.
So she clued into what I needed and got me out of there. I think we were in and out in 30 seconds. That's how fast it was.
Wow.
Next up, combining performance and poetry. Andrea Gibson has won a number of slam poetry contests. This one reflects on the good things about America.
I just, I write a lot of bad things, a lot of angry things about this country that we live in here. And there was just a friend of mine, Derek Brown, he was putting out a book called The Good Things About America. And I was like, I could never write anything that will fit into that book because all I write is pissed off about America. But I started writing about my hometown, and this was in the book. I grew up in a little town in the woods in Maine. So this is my Good Things About America poem. Okay. We were chubby-faced school kids, Snicker bar windpipe, crab apple pirates, backward baseball cap, knee scrape snow angels, Dukes of Hazzard dreamers, bumper car bodied salamander catchers, Michael Jordan believers, I couldn't fly, but my hang time was 3 minutes and 10 seconds. Smart kids were stupid. Books were trees cut down. I was a tomboy in love with Malcolm Cushion. He had a birthmark the shape of Canada on his left cheek. The teachers didn't trust him. His mother was the accidental broken tooth in a bar fight. I had one black friend. Her name was Erica. She had a jackknife. She carved a gash into the center of her palm, another into mine, pressed our hands together and asked if I thought it would turn her blood white. I couldn't read her fear or hope. I thought history was over. I cried during the national anthem. Once I found a butterfly's wing on the sidewalk. I wanted to keep it, but I didn't. I knew there were things I should never find beautiful, like death and girls. On Saturdays, I walked around town with a wheelbarrow collecting aluminum cans. On Sundays, my father paid me a penny for every cigarette butt I'd pick up in the driveway. I was picking up cigarette butts when Tommy Chambers punched my tooth out. I spit on his bike seat and beat the crap out of his older brother. I started writing songs, recorded them on my ghetto blaster, and mailed the tapes to the local radio station, but they never played them because they never had good taste. My mother did. She was a secretary. Her fingernails were red, and she loved my father, who after the war became a mailman. So when I was a baby, my mother would carry me to the post office and weigh me on the postal scales. Once, years later, I got lost in the mail. The next day, I came home from college and corrected my father's grammar. When I was 10, my mother had another daughter. I'd heard babies sometimes die in their sleep. So when my parents went to bed, I'd put on my Karate Kid kimono and sneak into a room to guard her heartbeat. The heartbeat thieves didn't find her for 15 years. At 11, I discovered beer. At 13, shame. At 19, I nailed my palm to Amanda Buckner's... actually drooled on her breast and said yes so loud, God couldn't disagree. But my family did, so I lost them for a while. And in that while, my Uncle Barry lost his fingers to the paper mill. My Uncle Peter lost his liver to Vietnam. My mother lost her legs to God's will. In her will, I inherit everything. The 17 photographs we didn't lose in the fire, all of them with charcoaled edges. My mother holds them to her chest and tells me she can still smell the smoke. I tell her I will guard them well. My father's freckled shoulders, my sister's brown, brown eyes, my mother's patient hands buckling my tiny blue suspenders that one December when we built a bonfire in the middle of the frozen lake and I skated around its flames with my snowsuit's frozen zipper sticking to my tongue. My mother said, smile for the camera. I can still remember the flash and that enormous fire with the ice beneath it that didn't even crack.
Creating art, creating life. Both are women's work. Alice Swan shares the story of having her first son in installment number 8.
I was 2 weeks overdue. I started labor on my own the night before I was scheduled to be induced. My contractions were 30 minutes apart when they started, which I subsequently have learned is generally a bad sign that you're going to be in for a long, a long labor. But all night, things were progressing. They were getting stronger, closer together. We called the hospital, and we were almost to the point of, you know, lasting 5 minutes apart, lasting 1 minute for an hour or something like that. We were almost to that point, and then it stopped. So we had called our families, said we're going to the hospital, and then it just kind of stopped. So I had a doctor's appointment that morning, and I went in, and the doctor stripped my membranes and then said, go to the hospital at 5 today, because if things are progressing, you will need to go in, and if they aren't, we're going to induce. And I just didn't question it, and I went in, and things had, I mean, the contractions had started up again. So we went in, and the first thing that they wanted to do when I got there was break my water. And I just sort of said, okay, I guess that's what we do. But my son was posterior, and he got stuck that way because once you break the water, there's not much room for the baby to be able to turn. And so I never dilated past 5 centimeters, and I had Pitocin after, you know, after I don't know how many hours, but, you know, I have been at 5 centimeters for... Pitocin is the synthetic, it's like the drug that causes contractions that they give you to induce labor or to augment labor. And it's really awful because it causes really strong contractions that are really close together. And especially if you've been, you know, up for 2 nights, as I had been when I got it already, it's just, it's really hard. And the Pitocin then caused Rex to go into fetal distress. And so they stopped, and then they started it up again at a lower dose, and it's still, he still wasn't responding well to it, and I still wasn't dilating anymore. And so then I had surgery, and, you know, 10 minutes later, he was born.
More music from Daisy May.
I need to find a new idea. All my old ones are kind of dated. Another place where I could meet some new friend. The time has come to make a stand towards a new way of thinking and stop running backwards to my old mistakes. Someone will be there waiting, even though I won't be begging for new love with me. This guy will have to be so caring, and no challenge to have me smiling for new love with me. Thank you.
Daisy May, A New Love Affair. Jeanette Jadot does the lead vocals for Daisy May. It's a bluesy jazz group from France. Women's work is, well, everything. Up next in our collection of summer shorts is three pieces from working women. Edie Hilliard is an expert in her field, a radio executive, mentor, and leader. Her take on radio trends and on women's roles in radio is the subject of installment number 9.
The industry is so controlled by men who are really pretty convinced that women don't want anything other than music on the radio stations. Pretty convinced that the only talk that will work is hot political talk, either conservative political talk a la Rush Limbaugh or hot talk a la Howard Stern or Tom Likas, neither of which appeals to women. And I mean, the numbers are there. In Arbitron, you can tell women don't listen, don't like. It's very interesting with women, for example. If you look at the 18 to 34 demo, the audience has declined in the last 7 years on commercial radio stations. Women, 18 to 34, there is 22% less listening in 7 years. Less time spent listening, almost as big a cum. Mm-hmm. People tuning in, but they're just not spending as much time because they don't find it satisfying. Right. During that same period, 25% increase in women's listening to NPR. That tells you they're looking for information, they're looking for something they can't get on commercial radio. Mm-hmm. And I think some things need to change.
How do you know when your work is making an impact? When Oprah covers it? Dr. Lisa Diamond's research shows quite clearly that women's sexual identity is fluid. That some women, as opposed to most men, can be attracted to and in sexual relationships with men or women, depending on circumstance. It's a new way of thinking about women's sexuality, without a clear gay-straight divide. This new way of thinking about sexuality is gaining some traction, it seems. Here's researcher Lisa Diamond.
Well, you know, I was on Oprah. So and you know, and not like that means anything except for the fact that if a topic ends up on Oprah, it clearly has, you know, reached some threshold of, you know, awareness. And it's interesting how I hear more about these ideas, you know, and it's funny because, you know, when I was on Oprah, and my partner, you know, was in the audience. And they played, like, Oprah likes to play, like, warm-up music. So they were playing I Kissed a Girl. And the audience members, many of whom are, like, these conservative Southern, you know, women who, like, have traveled from Mississippi to see Oprah, and their grandmothers, they're, like, dancing and they're singing I Kissed a Girl. And my partner said that she was just sort of amazed. And she said, you know, Lisa, you've been... you know, doing this work for years and years and years, and everyone's like, oh, fluidity, whatever. And she was like, and all of a sudden it was like everybody kind of like got it and was okay with it. And she's like, it's not like nothing has changed, but suddenly there's some threshold of awareness where this is no longer a strange idea, where old women are singing I Kissed a Girl and they're not totally freaked out by it. They're not screaming and running away. They're like, oh, I kind of know someone that's kind of fluid. So I do think that there is a little bit, and you see now on television shows, although you know, I have some beef with the way these things are represented on TV and movies. So you see more often now characters will have like one little affair with a woman and then the character will go back to being totally straight. So on one hand, we were like, oh, isn't that great? That's like sexual fluidity. It's like a fluid heterosexual woman. My problem is that on one hand, yeah, I think it's great to have images out there of women, you know, having these experiences and not like dying or being and like having it be like a positive thing. On the other hand, these characters almost always go back to being completely heterosexual. So it's like, ooh, isn't it titillating and fun to see the woman kiss another woman and then, oh, don't worry, next week she'll be right back where she belongs. So I'm not so sure how revolutionary that is, although I think it's better than no visibility. But clearly if those images are out there, people are viewing that that they're intelligible, you know, they're legible to the viewership of like, oh, I heard about someone who did something like that. So I do think it's sort of bubbling up in different places. But you will never see a heterosexual male character have a little dalliance with a man and then go back to being straight. You will not see that. That narrative is utterly missing.
Okay, so we've heard from a woman who works as a psychology researcher and one who works as a radio executive. In the third world, women's work is a bit different. Offaline Rosemond talks about women's work in Haiti, and Nancy Casey interprets.
And I've chosen pictures that especially are related to the idea of women and their work. One of the ideas in my community is that women don't work, and yet they do all kinds of work, such as carrying water, that they just don't receive any money for. It's not uncommon for somebody to walk an hour or an hour and a half one way to find a bucket of water. You could look at this picture and call it a whole theater presentation. So even though people aren't moving around, I can talk about it like it's a play in front of my eyes. There's a young girl there who's gone to the water, she's looking around and she sees the boy that she thinks is cute. And the boy starts paying attention to her. The next thing you know, she's pregnant and the boy doesn't have anything to do with her. And we think about one of the sort of biggest contexts that a girl can get into the kind of trouble that makes her life take a detour is the water, because everybody goes there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of young girls who don't go to school, and water is a need that their families have, so they make that trip an hour away from home down to the water to carry buckets and jugs.
You're now up to installment number 12. Number 12 of 16 in this collection of short pieces. You're listening to Yin Radio's Summer Shorts. And now it's time to go around town and ask people a little bit about what they think of, well, all kinds of things. First, Renee Pope asks her family and friends about pet peeves.
What is your pet peeve?
Well, I think my pet peeve is when, I don't remember. Probably when people, disrespect you when they know that they're disrespecting you. Like, they're like, they know that you don't like it, but they do it anyways.
Yeah. People who say they can't do something. How do you know if you don't try?
Mom,
your turn.
Okay, what is a pet peeve?
Oh, what is my pet peeve? My pet peeve is obnoxious drivers.
What are your pet peeves?
Oh, jeez.
If you just give me one of your most annoyed pet peeves.
People that don't speak English really annoys me.
That's not very
liberal.
No,
I'm sorry. It's not liberal, but it's true. It irritates the heck out of me when people call into work and they can't speak to me. Let me think.
That was racist.
It's not racist.
It isn't.
It just irritates me.
I don't like people, show-off, boastful people. They kind of bother me a little bit. If they have nothing to show off about, if they're just doing it to do it, it bothers me.
Yeah. Big pet peeve is when people pat me on the back.
Oh.
Yeah, I really hate that. It's almost kind of demeaning, good job, yeah.
Good job, good little buddy.
Yeah.
And I ask people around town, around town so to speak, about their comfort with nudity. This was as we soaked with strangers, half of us naked, in a natural hot spring.
Came up with the right question.
How comfortable are you, as we sit around here, half of us naked, with nudity? Mm-hmm. Your own body and that of others?
Start with
you go first, Andrea.
I'm pretty comfortable with it, as you can see.
I know this is the radio, but if you could see me now, you would know what I mean.
It would not be. We could not. If it were not radio, we wouldn't be able to air it.
Well,
in prime time.
Darling, nobody cares about me, but on the air, I would be better naked if I'm on radio than on TV, if you know what I mean.
Not true.
All right, that's my answer.
I'm actually pretty comfortable, but I don't like, I still think from other people's perspective, so I don't want to make other people uncomfortable. And when I arrived here and there were so many people in the pool, I was just like, oh, I'm not going to mess with, you know.
So you arrived and everybody was clothed?
Yeah, they were all clothed, so I just hopped in clothed. And went with that. And now it's funny, we're like making the transition.
Not me, I was here a couple weeks ago, and there was a pool full of mostly guys, and they looked like they were maybe a little bit redneckish, and everyone was wearing clothes, and I was like, hey guys, watch this, I'll clear the pool out. So I went and got in, stood there for a little bit, let them, you know, soak me in, and sure enough, after being in the pool for a good 10-15 minutes, a bunch of them got up and left. So.
Do you think that was directly due to your nudity?
I was the naked guy, the only one, so. And it's for you listeners at home, I'm pretty hideous looking, so. About 450 pounds.
Is he milking
for radio.
It or what?
Face for radio.
What does he want to hear next? Oh, he's the best looking one in here.
Bow, chick, bow, bow.
We're on radio.
Well, on the hike up here, we were told there was a couple of cougars up here.
It took me forever to figure out what you meant.
I know, I was like, yeah, there was some dead kill on the way in.
Yeah.
That's us.
A little tufted rabbit fur on the log.
Yeah. Like,
anybody else?
Well, I feel pretty comfortable with my nude body and everything, but sometimes I feel like I don't want everybody to see it. You know, you have to be privileged.
Sounds like you're
not alone. No, there's a challenge going on. We're not very privileged, obviously. The radio community doesn't know she's in her bikini.
I've actually always been very comfortable in my nude state, and especially in these hot springs up here. But tonight, when there were so many people in the pool, like Patty said, I was like, oh, I'll just go in my boxers. But then when I dropped my drawers, I was wearing my long johns, and they weren't on, so I was like, oh, I'm going in naked. And I've never regretted the decision at all.
Dan likes to go to the hot springs naked. Don't let him fool you.
I'm definitely
And a couple of cougars followed you in, so.
Dan was the lead for me because I was the second naked person in, and the only reason I was naked was because Dan was naked. I even gave the pool an option. I stood there in my underwear. I did. I said, you guys, I
could
come in.
Would you like to see
the
rest?
This is my underwear. Or if that would offend you, you know, or, I mean, if I would offend you. And they're like, no, take it all off. So I'm like, okay. So I did.
That's awesome.
Isn't that what happened?
Kind of like that.
I didn't used to be very comfortable with my nudity because I was raised Mormon in a very sexually repressed atmosphere. And it took me a bit. Actually, it was the hot springs that did it. But it's very liberating feeling, and you know, to shed those inhibitions and that false sense of shame for your body.
I agree with you. My experience is very similar. I don't know if it was related to religion or just being uncomfortable with my body. And I'm not saying I'm that much more comfortable now, but.
You look
I don't care as much.
Honey.
I just don't care as much.
Well, you look
you know?
Pretty good.
Well, thank you.
I haven't seen you looking this comfortable in a long time, honey, with a recorder and a cigarette and a big smile on your nude body.
I was born naked.
That is great.
On the radio, I guess.
When I was a little kid, I lived in Pennsylvania.
I didn't scare you.
And my like neighbors would bring me home and ask my mom if this was hers.
Not a Jasmine.
There'd be a trail of clothes down the block.
Andrea was just kidding.
Really?
This is your natural state, and you know it.
Oh,
but then later on, I was also raised in the Mormon faith, and so all those natural feelings got repressed.
And I'm back, baby.
Now, there's no way to follow that one except, of course, with more nudity. Ah, nudity. That freedom from civilization and self-consciousness. What a rare pleasure to revel in the naturalness of no clothes in a natural setting. What a rare pleasure to find that opportunity safely away from the civilization that cares too much about such things. What a rare pleasure to have nature offer the perfect temperature of air, covering of water, and then the surprising joy of full moonlight that allows complete revelry in such a simple thing as nudity. How rare to share these opportunities, these fortunate circumstances, and complete nudity with others of such diverse backgrounds. Had I been there alone, surely I would have bothered to dance naked in that brilliant moonlight, embraced by the sounds of the river and the warmth of the air and the solid walls of the canyon. I would have thought of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, which everyone should sing from time to time. But I sang that song with many others, some of whom shared a camaraderie of like minds, some of whom shared a camaraderie of alcohol. Many were close to disbelief the next day. I was not. I want to go back and dance in the full moonlight, unencumbered by clothes and fears and societal rules. I want to celebrate my wonderful, mobile, strong, imperfect body, rejoice in its assets and the part of it that's me, so integral to the whole of me. I want to praise the moving water, the changing beaches, the rocks and logs, the basalt and sedimentary canyon walls, and, of course, the moon, with the appreciation of a pagan and the awe of a child. As often as possible, and especially when life is just too serious and unnatural, I will dance naked in the moonlight, or starlight, or rain, celebrating me and the fields or trees, or a fire or the snow, depending on what nature offers. Sandy, the strong, the beautiful, the wise, the accidental creature who, somehow, came to be, to love, to hope, fortunately, but who doesn't know what to do with it that's of value or that makes a difference. Does it matter anyway? I will still be love and hope. We're on the home stretch now with just two more installments on this summer shorts program. Both offer advice and inspiration. Installment number 15 comes from motivational speaker Nancy Hunter Denny.
So I congratulate you for coming to a program called Zing, just to add that little kick that, I don't know, you might need sometimes. When you're feeling invisible, I'm going to teach you how to validate yourself. I'm going to try to share with you just some strategies on how you take this thing called life and give it a little bit more meaning, if you will. How to kind of get that thing you need, that it, if you will, when you're looking for it and it's just not there. I mean, I have gone all around the country, shown up, been behind a podium, only to see people.
Check out.
And I'm thinking, I'm talking to myself. And then I say to myself, girl, you need a little zing right now. You need this thing that's going to give you that energy. Or said another way, friends, that hope that you matter. And it's my hope that you leave here knowing that one person can, in fact, change the world. It's my hope, students, that you leave here knowing higher education is designed to give you what you want. And that is permission. It's my hope, faculty, staff, administrators, that you leave here knowing that you may not know when, often you may not know how, but just that you do make a difference. Influence is in the eye of the beholder more than we care to admit. Sometimes the most powerful things we say comes in our silence. Sometimes the best things we can do for people, especially the ones who push us farthest away, is keep following them. Sometimes, friends, we don't even know what it is. We don't know. But we have to accept the fact that ignorance is an indication, when we accept it, of our wisdom.
Annamaria Roque, who interned for Yin Radio in 2008 and 2009, recorded that last piece. And it's Anna who wraps up today's show with advice that she had written for the new year, or for any time of the year.
Starting over. We do it so many times in our lives. It is a continuous process. We're always reshaping our lives, redefining ourselves, and rethinking our decisions and looking for new beginnings. The most popular time of the year to do this is New Year's, of course, with all those well-intended yet rarely met resolutions. But we do it all the time. Every time we move, every school or career change, after every breakup, etc., etc. I was fortunate enough to get many, many opportunities to start over. There must be some nomadic blood flowing through my parents' veins because growing up, I never lived anywhere longer than 3 years, forcing me to start over, make new friends, try to fit in, over and over again. I was constantly trying on new things and evolving myself as a person. The first big challenge came 9 years ago when my dad stood at the bottom of the stairs and called for us, two 12-year-olds and a 9-year-old, to come downstairs. Emotions ran high as my parents told us that we would be moving from North Holland to Southern Germany. I was so upset, I didn't talk to them for a week. The paint in that house had barely even dried, and we were already moving again. And to a different country, even. I had to adapt to a new culture, learn a new language, and try to figure out what it means to be a Dutch girl in southern Germany. Almost exactly 3 years later, my parents once again called us downstairs for a family meeting, announcing that we would be moving yet again, and this time to the States. Although we had adapted quite well and made many friends in Germany, all of us were excited to move. My siblings and I had never heard about Idaho before. But it couldn't possibly be that different from what we had seen in popular movies and TV series, right? However, on the flight to Boise, the planes became smaller and smaller after every layover, and I started to worry. It was dark as we flew into the Boise airport, and the lack of lights below my little airplane window was not a good sign. Turns out Idaho is nothing like the America you see in movies. Coming originally from a country that is only 1/7 the size of Idaho, but has a population of 16.5 million people, Idaho is deserted. At 15, almost 16, coming into the midst of high school, I experienced a culture shock unlike anything I had experienced before. Trying to fit in was harder, and the swinging puberty hormones weren't helping. The labels of foreigner, European, different, just felt so tight and restricted. Moving on to college 2.5 years later was again another opportunity to redefine myself. This time, I fully embraced it, found my strengths, my passions, myself. Learning to stand strong and be comfortable in my own skin, ditching the assigned labels and proudly wearing only those that I picked. Now when I think of starting over, I think of Legos, something I loved as a kid. You can build anything your mind comes up with, and if you don't like it, you take it apart and start over. Life can be like that. Don't like the life that you've built for yourself? Start over. Move to a place where no one knows you and you can be anyone you want to be, and build a new life for yourself. After all, the first step towards getting somewhere is to decide that you're not going to stay where you are. Yes, starting over can be scary, but it is also very, very exciting. It's like the first page of a new blank journal. The pages, screaming to be filled, and the possibilities of what those will be filled with is an adventure in itself. Or it's like going to a beach, writing your name in the sand, and letting the wave wash it all away, allowing you to write and rewrite your name over and over and over again.
That makes 16 installments of Summer Shorts. We're going to have Daisy May take us out with the song The Business of Breaking Men's Hearts. Catch past shows and podcasts at www.yinradio.org. Yinradio.org is also where you can sign up to receive updates about the program or make a much-needed contribution to support Yin Radio. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow, in Moscow, Idaho, by BP Foundation. I'm Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Thanks for joining me. Catch you next week. Track back.